Ready?
Ready.
Welcome to the Connections Podcast, a podcast devoted to exploring the lives of people in our community at the Unitarian Universalists of San Mateo. I'm your new host, Becky Howland. That's right. The previous podcast host, Jack Brennan, and I have agreed to switch roles.
No, we haven't agreed to do
that. Well, technically, I didn't ask you yet. So let's make that the opening question of our podcast.
No, no, you're supposed to start the opening with that second part of my bio.
Jack, that is not how the podcast works now because I've taken it over. I am the host.
You're not the host. I'm the host of the podcast. You're the guest host.
For those of you who can't see Jack's face, I'm getting one of those looks. They are very scary. So I'm going to move on to the first question.
Okay.
I like being the podcast host even more than being Pobot. And I love being Pobot. So how would you feel about serving out the rest of my term as Pobot while I host your podcast just through June?
I think that you don't have the power, even as Pobot, to do that. I'm pretty sure, according to the bylaws, I would have to be elected. And to be elected, I think I would have to quit my job. And I love my job.
Oh.
So, yeah, we're not doing that. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now that we have that important question behind us, we're going to move on to more traditional subjects. In the first part of this podcast, we talked about Jack's childhood, marriages, kids, grandkids, and volunteer projects. We also talked about the proper pronunciation of her first name, which I understand is Jack.
Yes.
The second part will focus on Jack's professional life as an attorney, her religious biography, and her 20 months at UUSM. We might cover a few more topics too, Jack, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
The first question is, how is your last name pronounced? I've heard both Brenham and Brennan. Is either of those your chosen pronunciation? And if not, what is your chosen pronunciation?
I pronounced both my first name and my last name in part one of our interview. So feel free to go back and check pronunciations there.
Thank you, Jack. Brenham. I have an easier question to ask now.
Yeah.
What made you decide to become an attorney?
Oh, that's much easier.
It is easier. Yeah.
It's a good question. I never knew any attorneys growing up. I did watch Perry Mason.
Oh, yes.
And Matlock and L.A. Law.
Right.
So I pretty much didn't need to go to law school, really. I didn't really know much about the law at all. Where I started getting into law before I became a lawyer was with my kids who had disabilities. And I was advocating for them in school settings and medical settings.
As a parent.
And legal settings, because we had some pretty big litigation around a couple of those adoptions, like National Spotlight.
Oh my gosh.
Time Magazine. And
wow.
Really, yeah. I won't even be talking about that today just because we have time limits. But in addition to that, I did discover that I could get things for my kids, especially in school, by just looking at the law and using the words in the law. That started me thinking about a career change.
Yeah.
I was married to Tom, and he had started the job working for DuPont the day after he graduated from high school. He'd never worked anywhere else, and he hated it. Every day that he worked there. He really wanted to retire early. When he was 50, he could retire early.
Okay.
And he wanted to be able to do that. But then, how would we live? So, little things.
Yeah.
So I just decided it was time for me to pull that cart for a while. And I didn't have anything marketable enough to support our family. So I knew from L.A. Law that all lawyers are rich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And beautiful.
Yeah. It's
they have nice cars.
Really. Right.
Yeah.
So I decided to go to law school. And okay. That's how I made that decision.
Yeah. Okay, that's a wonderful way to decide to become an attorney.
Yeah. It worked too.
Think about your favorite place that you worked as an attorney and tell me what it was like.
Ooh. I've loved nearly everything I did as an attorney. I loved having my own 14-lawyer law firm. I loved that. I loved working at a nonprofit, advocating for people with disabilities. For sure, the best bosses I ever had were Wendy Wilkinson and Lori Redd, and that was when I was working at a nonprofit as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2006, I started teaching the paralegal program at U of H. And
U of H is what?
University of Houston.
Oh, yeah. H is Houston.
Yes,
I should have known that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should have. I couldn't go to the University of Hawaii or anything. Mm-hmm. I only ever lived in Houston before here. Eventually, that job really put all of my professional dreams to shame. The perfect job for me.
Mm.
It was the blend of my two favorite pursuits, which were the law and teaching.
Yeah.
I love to teach. Mm. I love to teach anything. When I was little, I took piano lessons for the first time. I would come home and teach the kids in my neighborhood the stuff that I had learned.
So you love to teach.
I do love to teach. I did and I do. I discovered I was good at taking legal concepts and terminology and all that and making it accessible to non-lawyers.
Yeah.
That part was the most fun. And I made a difference in the lives of people. I still get emails from former students. I keep in close touch with a lot of my former students. The idea of leaving the world a better place than I found it is appealing. Mm-hmm. And I try to do that on a micro scale every day. And the only reason I stopped teaching the paralegal program was because I moved out here. Because I did have to teach it online during COVID, at least during the very early stages of COVID, I thought I could still teach some classes online. And I do still teach some classes online.
Yeah. And you teach for UUSM. I know you teach Starting Point.
Yeah.
And you teach Justice Circle. Or you lead Justice Circle.
Right.
But that's kind of teaching.
It is really. A little.
Yeah. It's mostly teaching. Yeah.
And I've taught a constitution class online out here
that
a lot of UUSM people participated in.
Yeah,
as
I listened
well
in
as
on that
the
one.
RBG class.
Right.
At Bader Ginsburg.
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Talking about religion, since we've kind of transitioned to teaching about law.
Okay.
And that, to teaching about religion.
All right. Sure.
I mean, I'm very into these smooth transitions.
Yes, no. Flawless. No notes.
Tell me about your religious background. You said you were not always a UU. Let's talk about your religious background next.
Okay.
Now, according to chapter 17 of the autobiography you sent me, Jack was raised in a Christian church called Central Park Church of God that her grandmother, Bessie Durden, helped to found.
Right.
It was a smallish church and a great community in which to grow up. So how did you go from there to UU congregation?
Wasn't a straight shot between the two.
Yeah.
But that church really was a great community. That reminds me a lot of UUSM, just in the size of it and how close people were.
Mm-hmm.
I was in high school. I started attending the Catholic Church. Honestly, I loved the ritual of the Mass. I really loved that ritual.
Yeah.
I didn't really buy into the religious beliefs of the church by then, but I wasn't yet calling myself an atheist. But I was really involved in music, and I would play the piano and the organ, and I sang in folk groups, so that I was in five or six Masses every weekend.
Wow.
But outside of the music, I wasn't really that involved in the church.
Yeah.
And when I married Tom, he'd been a Catholic all his life, but we couldn't get married in the Catholic church.
Because?
Because we were divorced.
Oh, right.
That's how we ended up going to a Unitarian church. Mm. And I belong to two UU congregations in Houston at different times. Emerson Unitarian, where I also worked, and then Bay Area Unitarian Fellowship, which is what it was at that time. Now it's Bay Area Unitarian Universalist Church, because California is not the only place with a Bay Area.
Oh, I get. Well, that makes sense. So while you're talking about Houston,
okay,
let me just insert a question here. Listeners actually sent this question in. What do you miss about Houston, and whom do you miss most in Houston besides family?
Okay. The what do I miss is pretty easy. I thought I would miss a lot about just Houston itself, mm-hmm. because I really loved Houston.
Yeah.
But I have found that I don't miss things in Houston much at all. Oh, I miss thunderstorms.
Oh, I agree. Totally agree with you there.
I miss thunderstorms a lot.
Yeah.
The only place I miss is Eastwood, which was our old neighborhood where we lived for a long time, James and I. And we lived there for about nearly 20 years. And it was the only neighborhood I've lived in since I was a kid where everybody knew each other. And we got together all the time for parties, for happy occasions and sad occasions. And if anybody ran for anything, political campaigns. Yeah. And it was just the best feel in a community that I ever had. And I miss my Eastwood gang for sure.
Yeah.
And in terms of who, obviously I miss my kids a lot, and grandkids, and all the family. And Jen Cabrera, she is the person who took my class, and then she worked as a paralegal, and then she went to law school, and then she became a famous lawyer. She got all kinds of awards. But all throughout that time, we kept in touch, and she always said that if I ever wanted to stop doing the class, she would like to do the class. And so she is now doing the class. We have daily contact. I miss Beth Suffian and Lori Hammonds and Kathy Hale and Jackie Hansen. And it's always real scary to just name a few people and then have other people say like, hey, you didn't name me.
Yeah, come on, you forgot me.
But that's like probably my tightest circle in terms of who I was close to and still am really close to.
Yeah. Thank you. That was sweet. Now, back to religion.
Okay.
Yeah. I know that often on this podcast, you ask about how the guest ended up at UUSM. But I think I already heard your story. So just tell me if this is the right story.
Okay.
I heard you were planning to move to the West Coast because you'd already made friends with everyone in Texas, right?
Well, I mean, everybody in Houston.
Oh, okay.
There are 3 million people there. Yeah. Kind of a small town.
Yeah, so you ran out of.
Yeah. Takes me a long time to do my Christmas cards every year.
And then you chose California because it's the only state that has more people than Texas to make friends with, right?
Well, Houston alone is the fourth largest city in the whole country. And Texas, I just saw the other day, is the fastest growing state in the U.S. And I think that's because of the excellent leadership we have. Future President of the United States, Greg Abbott, and soon to be felon Ken Paxton as our Attorney General, and all of our freedom-loving laws. I have friends who now live in California because of the laws against transgender care for children. And of course, it's a terrible place politically.
All right. So this is why you moved to California. And then when you were choosing a church community, you chose UUSM because Ellie was there, right? I mean, she is a rising youth star at UUSM, and incidentally your granddaughter. But if that's not fully correct, please tell our listeners the full story.
That is not fully correct.
Oh, okay.
And I'm a little lightheaded from you saying something that's not fully correct.
Oh,
that just never happens.
Yeah.
We moved to California because my daughter Kendra has lived out here with her husband Chris and eventually their three kids for years. They've lived out here. And they are the ones who made it possible for us to move out here. And we're so grateful because we really love it here. And we love it so much more than we anticipated. And Thelma and Louise, our beagles, they really love it out here too.
Oh. You moved to Pacifica to be with Kendra and her family.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your other kids. I mean, we talked about them really briefly in the first part.
Right.
But I'd like to hear more about them. I know that you've lost two children. You've had two tragedies.
Yes.
You lost Megan fairly recently, just a handful of years ago. And I know that Tyler died as a baby. I want to hear more about your kids, about them and also about the others.
Okay. Let's talk about Tyler and Megan first. Tyler was born in November of 1994, and he died the next January, 1995.
Yeah.
And his birth parents found out during the pregnancy that the baby had Down syndrome. And so they asked us to adopt him even before he was born.
The birth parents did?
Yes. We were there for his birth and even for some late medical appointments because I really wanted them to get this certain heart test that you could get in utero. So they did that, and they discovered that he had heart defects, problems with his heart. We knew that going into his birth, that that was coming. And we took him home. He was 3 days old. He had a hole in his heart, an enlarged heart, additionally. And we saw the pediatric cardiologist. They planned surgery for the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And the morning that he died, I picked him up out of his bassinet, and he felt cool to the touch. That was my first sign that there was something unusual. As I was changing him, Tom came over and started talking to him, and Tyler had these eyes that would just pull you in. And you could never feed him and watch TV or something because you just had to look at his eyes. His eyes demanded that. And he was looking around and seemed like he couldn't focus. I tried to feed him, but he wouldn't take the bottle. He pushed out with his tongue. So I put him up on my shoulder and I could physically feel his heart beating because his heart was big, and I could always feel it beating against me right here when I had him up there. And his heart just stopped beating. And I felt it stop. I started infant CPR. Tom called 911, but I knew he was gone then.
Yeah.
Even when I started CPR, I thought at first breath was coming out, but I realized it was just what I was
pushing in.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So now I'm the one with the hole in my heart.
Yeah.
It was really hard.
I think about, though, given that he was going to die, having him just pressed against you, it's kind of the best way.
It was the sweetest kind of goodbye. You know, it was, I held him, Tom held him. They took him, we called 911, fire department, and the paramedics came, and they really couldn't do anything. And he was gone, but took us to the hospital. I called my friend Susan. She went and got kids out of school and brought them up there to say goodbye. And at the hospital, they kept his body warm so that the kids could all say goodbye. So it, as good as it could have been. I wasn't home by myself, and there's a million ways it could have been.
And he wasn't all by himself. He was with you. And Tom. Heartbreaking.
Rough one. It did, in a way, once I went through that, I felt bulletproof. You know, I felt like I made it through that. There was nothing I couldn't do. And that same year I started law school. So, yeah. Megan died in 2017.
Yeah.
Just a couple of weeks before her 29th birthday.
Yeah.
In fact, we had her service on her birthday. Meg had a tough time in school, not academically. She was smart, but mm-hmm. she was teased and bullied a lot because she had this facial abnormality, a missing facial nerve. Mm-hmm. As a teen, she skipped school a lot. She would sneak out of the house at night. I remember one time in particular, the phone rang around midnight, and I picked it up, and it was a sheriff's deputy of a town that was outside of Houston, and he asked me if I was Megan Brennan's mother, and I said I was, and he said, well, I've got Megan here with me. And I said, well, that's impossible because yeah. she's asleep in her room. And and he said, yeah, I'll hold on while you go check on that. Megan's life situation, I mean, it definitely went downhill for a while. And she didn't really turn her life around until she got pregnant. And that mm-hmm. is what did it for her. Mm-hmm. Her son, Casey, was born in February of 2011. Uh-huh. Megan was a really good mom, and she had the good fortune of parenting with Jeremy, who was a really good dad. Mm-hmm. And they got married a couple of years later. It's so funny when you try to do this quickly, so skipping a whole lot, but
of course.
Meg wanted a motorcycle from the time she was 16. Yeah. She ended up that year, 2017, taking a motorcycle safety course and getting her license to mm-hmm. operate a motorcycle, and got her helmet and her other protective gear. And 10 days after she got her coveted motorcycle, she was riding on a beautiful windy day in Austin, Texas, where she lived. She was on a what they call a flyover, which is, you know,
an overpass,
yeah. sort of. She was having a lot of trouble handling the bike because it was a windy day and she was up really high. And I talked to the drivers who were watching her mm-hmm. and as she was getting pushed to the right by the wind, and so she was pushed to the guardrails mm-hmm. and the guardrails sit at just the right point for motorcyclists to go over.
Oh my gosh.
That's what happened. A gust of wind, and it just blew her off her bike. Her bike continued down the path it was going because it was against the guardrail, but she fell 108 feet to her death.
How terrible. What an awful thing to go through.
It was. It really was. She was wearing her helmet. She was mm-hmm. wearing all her protective gear, but mm-hmm. 108 feet.
And doing all the right things.
Yeah. She wasn't speeding. Right. It was afternoon, and she was on her way to pick up Casey, and
that's what happened. Oh boy.
So when people tell you that the death of a child is the worst thing that can happen to you, believe them. It really is.
Yeah.
Okay, got that behind us.
All right.
Of course, all my other kids are grown up. They're not really kids anymore, except to me. Danny is my oldest, and he's going to be 50 in February. I know.
Oh, my gosh.
He is an IP paralegal. He took my class and became a paralegal, switched from a sports radio to a career in the law. Danny also has Parkinson's, and he has other health challenges as well, which are now thankfully in remission. Danny and his wife, Kelly, who is an amazing graphics designer and does big branding campaigns, they have two kids, Leo Midnight and Rye Brightside. Mm-hmm. Danny taught me how to be a mom. I didn't know anything for that first kid. He taught me that. Mm. Then my oldest daughter is Kendra, who lives here, just two doors down from me, which is fantastic. It's so much fun to hear. When I have my bedroom window open, I can hear our kids playing in the backyard. Sometimes they're throwing football in the street, and it's just so nice to have them just so close.
Yeah. You know,
I've never lived that close to any of my grandkids, and it's just fantastic.
There's a couple of times I've called you on FaceTime, and one of your grandkids is there in the background.
It's so nice. It's really nice.
Yeah.
She is part of a bookkeeping business. They do work for nonprofits and small businesses who don't need full-time bookkeepers. Okay. Kendra and her husband, Chris, who works for Roblox. Look it up if you've never heard of that. But
I've heard of that one.
They have three kids, of course, the twins, Jack and Andrew, who are in high school now, and Ellie, who you know already.
I know Ellie. Yeah. She's our rising youth star.
She really does love UUSM. She really loves coming there.
It's wonderful.
Sean is a community partnership analyst for KIPP. And his wife, Cindy, is also a paralegal. Another successful graduate of my class. So,
okay.
Yeah. I really love their family, and they have four wonderful kidlets. They have their twins, Skylar and Miles, and then they have Millie and Mason, who is my youngest and maybe last grandchild. We'll see. Colin is a preschool teacher. He is married to Maria, who may be the hardest working person I know, and they have one daughter, Stacy, who is in kindergarten. Then
and they're in Houston area.
Everybody else is.
Everybody is. Okay, except for you and Kendra.
Jeremy lives in Austin with Casey. But most everybody is in the
Houston. Greater Houston.
Kelsey, Paul, and Bridget all live in different small group homes, and they're all doing well. Kelsey has Angelman syndrome, which is.
Don't know that
It's not common, fortunately. She's in her 30s, and she's still in diapers, and has no real communication ability. She has no language. It's a really tough one. Her IQ is like 19. So
it must be hard to measure if you can't communicate.
Yeah, it's very hard. But she's... always smiling, but it's an inappropriate kind of smile and laugh. Her syndrome, Angelman syndrome, is sometimes called happy puppet syndrome. Now, I'll say that people don't like that. They consider it derogatory.
Okay.
But it is descriptive, happy puppet, because she does have a wide gait, and she has her hands in the air most of the time when she's walking. And she is smiling all the time and laughing all the time, but not appropriately. One story that I often tell is that she was in the backyard, and she was walking towards us, and of course she was giggling and laughing, and I saw something on her leg, and I looked, and it was a fire ant, and so I got it off, and then saw another one further up, and when I opened her diaper, she it was full of fire ants.
Oh my gosh.
But she doesn't have appropriate...
Yeah.
Responses to things like that. You know? So
it's like she gets excited and everything comes out the
So
with the giggles and smiles.
Very tough
that
one.
That sounds really hard.
And Paul has Prader-Willi syndrome, which is definitely easier than Angelman. So Paul functions at about a 9 to 12-year-old level.
Okay.
He probably reads and writes at a maybe second grade level.
But he communicates.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah.
All the time. Paul FaceTimes us every day, at least once every day. And he's great. The odd thing about Prader-Willi syndrome is that people with Prader-Willi have an insatiable appetite.
Oh, I remember you told me about this.
They start out as failure to thrive infants. You're doing everything you can to get them to eat. We had to get special bottles that you could squeeze the milk into him because he would suck three times and then he was worn out.
Yeah.
So, and then about around the age of 3 to 5, they start developing this insatiable appetite. And at first, parents tend to really overfeed them because at last my child wants to eat.
Right.
At the time we had Paul, it was unusual to get a diagnosis so early.
Uh-huh.
Now it's more common, but back then they usually did wait until the appetite kicked in, and then somebody would say, oh, mm-hmm. I know this. This looks like this. But Paul would come home from preschool with a string around his neck because they'd made Fruit Loop necklaces, and he ate all the Fruit Loops on the way. Of course, my all-time favorite special education story, because I did end up suing a lot of school districts. When he went to junior high school, we took a tour of the junior high school. I'd already had kids there, so I knew what to expect. And they had vending machines in the lunchroom.
Mm.
I knew that was going to be a problem.
Right.
Paul would steal money so he could buy stuff out of the vending machines. I asked them if they could move them. They did. They moved them across the office, and the office was all glass, and so they could see him. Felt like we were in good shape. I talked to every teacher about the ways in which he would try to trick them and things like that.
You to, know, get food.
To get food.
Uh-huh,
he was really smart when it came to figuring out how to get food. None of that developmental delay or mental retardation, as they called it then, didn't play a part when it came to him figuring out how to get food. About 6 weeks into the school year, he had gained 12 pounds.
Whoa.
So I knew that he was feeding.
Somehow.
And so I called the principal. And she said, she was just astonished. She said, Paul is like the mayor of this school. Everybody knows Paul. He's so friendly and everybody loves him. And he reaches out to other groups of students like every day. He has lunch at a table full of blind students. And she didn't even hear herself until I started laughing and asked if the other students had lost 12 pounds during them. So I can just see him doing it. I can see him saying like, oh no, your mom did not send a sandwich today.
Yeah.
No, they were out of ice cream in the lunch line, you know? And So,
oh my goodness.
He's in a group home. He works a little. And he loves life, and it'd be hard to not hear from him every day, because routine is really important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a routine to our conversations. We have one part that's just devoted to ad-libbing what's going on.
Okay.
But other than that, it's a very proscribed conversation. And
is any of it about food?
Yes.
It is?
It's all about food.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. The first question he asked me is, did you have cereal for breakfast? Whether I did or not. I say, how did you know? And then he says, you have cereal for supper? And I'm always like, yes, but I had something extra, boiled egg. I was like, Paul, how did you figure that out?
Uh-huh.
I don't know how you do it. Then he tells us what he had.
Uh-huh.
Then with James, he has a different sort of thing, which I refuse to do with him, but James is a softer touch. So with James, Paul says, what did you have for breakfast? And James says, oatmeal. And he said, did you have oatmeal for breakfast? Paul, how did you figure that out? And I do every meal and snack.
Uh-huh.
He gets 3 meals and a snack at night. The food part is the most important part of that conversation. And then Bridget has Down syndrome. Kelsey was the child that we had the most legal trouble around.
Mm.
And that's the one that, you know, we were on TV and in the newspaper, front page of the Houston papers and in, around the country. In the midst of that, they were doing an interview in Tom, and we were still hoping to adopt a child who had Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bridget's birth parents had just had a child with Down syndrome. They saw that article and they called us and asked us if we would adopt their six-week-old daughter. So that was how we got Bridget. She is in daily touch with me. Mostly she texts me things she wants. Links to Amazon. Yeah, so she just sends me things she wants all the time. She calls 2 or 3 times a week, FaceTimes.
Wow.
But if you look at our text thread, it's just
links.
Thing after thing that she wants. So, that's my girl. I think that's it in a very large nutshell.
Yeah. And how do you talk about all of your children and give justice to describing every single one of them?
Yeah, I didn't do justice to it at all.
Yeah.
But people will get a better sense of.
That's a lovely overview. And then, you know, you can always go and talk to Jack. She's around the church now and then.
Yes, I show up from time to time.
Sometimes on Sundays.
Yeah, yeah. And so if you ever want to talk about anything, yeah. I'm always around.
Well, I have to say, Jack, I'm awfully glad that you found us.
Me too.
However that came about, you and your work have been just vital to our community, especially when we were trying to all put everything back together during and after the pandemic. I think it was having you come to us at that time was your gift.
Thank you.
I do want to talk to you about one more thing, and it's very personal. Okay. So if you don't want to talk about it, I'm sure you'll just edit it out because you're the editor.
That's right. You can ask me anything right now, Becky.
Right. But I do want to talk about it because you have spoken about your Parkinson's diagnosis.
No.
I want to know what it's like for you to have Parkinson's.
I don't ever mind talking about it, first of all. I want to say that. So I'm definitely fine with talking about it. The diagnosis was February 7th, I remember. I think I texted James and my kids and then you and Lori Fox. So
the Jabba group.
It was shocking that day. Later, James said, I don't know why we were so shocked. Why didn't we think it could have been that? Mm-hmm. But I've had this tremor in my right leg for a few years. And I went to a doctor in Houston about it before. He just said it didn't act like a Parkinson's tremor. At that time, I could still control it with positioning my leg in different ways. And so he said, if it gets worse, come back and see me. But for right now, I don't think we need to do hundreds of tests to when you still have this ability to control. It's not an uncontrolled tremor.
I remember when I first met you, and not long after I first met you, I asked you about it because I noticed that you had a tremor, and I'm very rude.
Sure, I still was really shocked. She did the tests, the traditional tests. Now they have an actual test you can do, but at that point, it was a clinical diagnosis only. When we got through, she said, tell me who in your family has Parkinson's. And I said, well, I've heard that my grandfather had it. I didn't know that grandfather. And my son has Parkinson's. And she said, and you have Parkinson's. And
I just got chills.
My first thought was, were you not listening to me? I said, my son. Right. And
not me.
I'm not talking. And then interesting. And then didn't hear anything else after that. I was thinking last night as I was handing out Halloween candy, this time last year, I still didn't know. You know, it's like a whole different thing to not know. But I will say last year at Halloween, I hurt my shoulder really bad. I've always had problems off and on with this one shoulder, which is definitely something that happens with Parkinson's. But of course, I didn't know. In fact, shoulder pain in one shoulder is a Parkinson's thing. Yeah. So I had that a whole lot. And last Halloween, when I was handing out candy, we had hundreds of trick-or-treaters here. Hundreds. I'm not kidding. And when I was handing out candy, too bad we're not on video for this, but, you know, you put your hand into the bowl and you see what that does to your shoulder, and then you put it into the kid's bag. And I just did that
rotating your shoulder
so many times that night that I couldn't move my shoulder the next day. Ultimately, I contacted the doctor, and then they sent me and they gave me PT, and I had PT all last fall for my shoulder. And it worked. It fixed it. But last night, I didn't do that. I presented the bowl and said, please take two things. The little kids didn't mostly get that, but the older kids loved getting to pick their own two things. It was great. This is just not what I planned for my life, this Parkinson's thing.
Yes.
I didn't plan for my so-called golden years to be Parkinson's patient.
Yes.
And
yes.
I still have a fair amount of grief in my day to day. Just coming to terms with that. I'm the caregiver. I'm not the person who needs care. That is my role is the caregiver. I'm the nurturer. I'm not the sick one. You know, and I have trouble with that. But like most people with Parkinson's, I have good days, pretty good days, and I have pretty bad days. And that's normal. Of course, I've educated myself. I've read everything I can find, and that is a lot. There is a lot to know about Parkinson's.
Yes.
I subscribe to several Parkinson's podcasts. I do every single thing that's recommended. I do lots of exercise. I do nearly 2 hours a day divided between yoga and balance work and cardio and strength. I also do online speech therapy. Nutrition is more important to me than it ever was. And I'm trying to just do what I can because there's so much I can't control at all. But this is a progressive disease. I'm not going to get better. I'm only going to get worse with this disease. And so if I can postpone even for just a little bit, some of the worst symptoms that I know are coming, the the most debilitating features of Parkinson's, then I'd like to do that.
Of course.
More than anything, I think being able to do something, whatever it is, is just way better than just giving up and admitting there's really nothing I can do. Being able to do something is good.
It feels particularly unfair to a person who's so capable. I mean, you're such a capable person, and just to have that control taken away just is...
It's rough.
It's rough.
People think of Parkinson's as being just about tremors and falling. And I started falling long before I got my Parkinson's diagnosis, and that's also very common. But there's a lot more to it than tremors and falling. There are more than 100 characteristics of Parkinson's. Some come and go, like anxiety and depression and lack of motivation. Those are three things I've never experienced before Parkinson's. And they come and go. Luckily, they don't come and stay for me at this point. Some things do come and stay. I don't like to dwell on the worst symptoms. Any night that brings me uninterrupted sleep makes the next day a lot better. But sleep disturbances are really common with Parkinson's. All kinds of sleep disturbances. Bad Parkinson's nights are definitely the worst symptoms for me. I'm coping. It's not fun. It's not fun to have Parkinson's. But it's also not the worst diagnosis you can get. People don't die of Parkinson's. People die with Parkinson's. So,
How can the UUSM community best support you as you're going through this Parkinson's journey?
Just be there. Ask me how I'm doing. Ask James how he's doing, because sometimes caretakers are caring a lot. If you see Elvis, which is of course my name for my right leg, acting up, don't be afraid to mention it. Elvis was going pretty wild on Sunday, but don't be afraid to talk to me about that or about anything to do with Parkinson's. I feel the love and I feel the support of this community every day. Even when I announced the diagnosis, I felt that support from them immediately.
What about your faith? Has your faith changed because of the Parkinson's diagnosis?
Faith is an interesting word because I'm an atheist, so I'd seldom use that word, faith. I do have faith in science and yoga and Barack Obama and friends and really good chocolate and the UUSM community.
And tea. Tea also.
Tea. Yeah, I have faith in tea. Parkinson's did not change my faith.
Okay. Okay. We're going to move from this very heavy topic of Parkinson's to some nice, light, quick hitters. How does that sound?
Quick hitters.
Yeah.
Hit me.
Okay, I'm going to hit you. Ready?
Sure.
I think I'm caught up on all the podcasts.
Excellent.
I'm just going to copy a lot of the questions that you use.
Sure.
Okay. So the first one is, what superpowers do you not have?
I don't believe I have any superpowers. All the ones you can think of?
Yeah.
I do not have those.
You don't have those?
No. I'm visible. I can't fly. I can't stop a moving train.
Yeah.
No superpowers.
Huh. All right, how about this?
Okay.
When you eat a late night snack, what is it, and how do you deal with the shame?
Okay, so here's the thing.
Yeah.
I, except for very specific social situations.
Yes.
I do not eat after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. During every 24 hours, yeah. I do 16 hours of not eating. What's sometimes called intermittent fasting, yeah. Or it's called scheduled eating. Mm-hmm. I do not have a late night snack.
Okay.
Ever.
Okay.
So therefore, I feel no shame.
You feel ever. No shame.
No, I feel no
do shame. Do people who do eat late night snacks, should they feel shame?
No. How can I say that when James has ice cream every single night?
Oh, I love ice cream. What kind of a sandwich is a hot dog?
What?
What kind of a sandwich is a hot dog?
What kind of a question is that?
You ask this question all the time.
No, I say, is a hot dog a sandwich?
It's the same question. What kind of a sandwich is a hot dog?
Yeah. It is not a sandwich. A hot dog is not a sandwich.
It's not. Okay. What is your favorite way of eating a hot dog? Which end do you start with? Or how do you decide which end to start with?
Well, you're assuming I start at an end.
Okay.
No, I do start at the end.
Which
and
one?
I start at the end closest to me. And by the way, I've never asked those questions.
I heard the one about the hot dog.
Just, is a hot dog a sandwich? That's
okay.
All I ask.
What's on your hot dog, though? What kind of condiments or pickles or onions or Texas barbecue?
I do it the way God intended.
Which is?
Relish and mustard.
Ooh, that sounds really good. I like your God.
Okay.
Have you ever had an ice cream sandwich? This is yes or no.
Yes, I have had an ice cream sandwich.
Okay. Okay. What is a certificate of awesomeness and how do you get one?
A certificate of awesomeness is a certificate that is given out by our administrator at UUSM, Kate Wasserman. And the only way you can get one is for Kate to decide that you deserve it.
Yeah.
And I got one.
Oh.
And you didn't.
Right. Thank you for answering these quick hitters so courteously. And even so, we're out of time.
What?
Yes. I hope you have enjoyed handing over the mic to me and inviting me to host this podcast.
Temporarily, Becky. That was just last week and today. That's it.
Temporarily. Right. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning into this Role Reversed podcast. Now, Jack, would you sing us out with a song? I'm wondering if you can sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
One syllable off.
One syllable off.
All right. Here we go.
Okay.
Me out to the ball game, take me out to the crowd, buy some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if we ever get back for a three-root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame for it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Take.
What should we say right to close it all off?
Keep making connections!